History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions, take the time to listen, and prepare to be amazed by what we hear. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, so often we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's going to be the case today with a 100-year-old ex-prisoner of war in Memphis, Tennessee. Normally, I get to introduce the veteran to you, but I'm going to pass that honor on to someone else today because I wouldn't have had the privilege of meeting this centenarian without an organization called Forever Young Veterans, which has been making a difference in the lives of veterans for the better part of two decades now. We're going to hear more about that mission down the road, and you can check them out online right now at foreveryoungvets.org. But let's have the founder of the Forever Young Veterans Foundation, Diane Height, introduce us to today's guest.
This is Luke McLaurin. He's 100 years old, and I've known him for about 15 years.
What was it initially that brought you together, and what has impressed you about him over those years?
Well, as you know, we take veterans on trips of honor. And so when we would go on a trip, the veterans would say to me, "Let's have a reunion." And I would go, "I don't have time to do reunions. I'm doing these trips." And so I thought, how can I solve this problem? So I decided that I would do a monthly meeting. And that way, the veterans that go on our trip, they could have this place to come and they could see each other. So I started that about 15 years ago. And that's actually how I met Luke. He came to one of our very first meetings. And Luke, being a former prisoner of war, when we had several prisoners of war in our group, when they found out that he was a POW, they immediately ran over to him and said, "Are you getting POW pay?" And that's how it all began, because they said, "We're going to help you." He wasn't. They said, "We're going to help you get this because you've earned it." And so after that very first meeting, he's been every month. And so he's been a big part of our organization.
And I know we're going to hear his story, and it's going to raise people's eyebrows and get their attention and give them perspective. But I'm sure over those 15 years, you've come to see more of who he is, and there's a reason he's so special to you. What is it that makes him so endearing to you and your organization?
Well, he is such a good man. He's a strong Christian. We bonded on many levels. I love his story. He lived in Memphis his whole life, and his parents owned the McLaurin Bakery in Memphis for over 50 years. He can tell you the exact time. And the thing about Luke that I love so much is, you know, after you go through something traumatic like being a prisoner, it changes everything. And he wanted to be in aviation when he got out of the war. But after being a prisoner, he didn't want to be away from his family, and he never dreamed that he would join them in the bakery. That was not his plan, but he realized what was important, and it was family, and so he joined them, and they worked together forever. And what I love about Luke is he was making wedding cakes, birthday cakes, and he said he quit counting after he made 10,000 wedding cakes. And he used to make the birthday cake, the guitar-shaped cake for Elvis Presley.
Well, I know we've got a lot to talk about. What a great introduction. A few spoiler alerts in there, but we'll hear it straight from the source. So, Luke, let's go back 100 years ago, born here in Tennessee. What do you remember about those early years through the Great Depression here in the Memphis area?
Well, fortunately, my family was in business, and we did not really suffer greatly like so many people did. The business was very good, So I was just grew up, and I went to school here and did the things that little kids do.
Well, I want to ask you more about that, but I'm aware that sometimes I forget things, and if I don't make a note, I miss it. So Diane dropped a big one there that I think all our listeners probably really want to know about Elvis Presley's wedding cake. Oh, his birthday cake. What was that shaped like?
It was always a guitar. Now, Elvis didn't buy these cakes. This was bought by his Memphis group, the president of the Memphis Association there for Elvis.
But you didn't hear any complaints? It didn't have like peanut butter and bananas in the middle or anything, did it?
Not this time. No. That didn't happen, but we did them every year for him. Elvis came in the shop at least three different times, and the sales ladies out front would always come back and say, "Elvis is out there."
Well, did they come back after he left and tell you he left the building?
That they didn't say.
Boy, there's so many Elvis cliches that are just popping into my mind right now. But let's talk more about Luke. So you're a boy growing up in a family bakery. How early did they put you to work in that bakery?
Well, really, I said that I was born under the counter, but I really wasn't. I was born in the hospital here. Yeah, well, I started working when I was about, my dad put me to work, I guess maybe 6 or 7 years old. I did it most of my life.
And Diane made reference to you're not planning to continue in the bakery business after the war. Was there a reason for that? Were there some tasks that you were given as a boy that you weren't particularly fond of?
Well, I was particularly interested in aviation. And when I graduated from high school, that was right after the war started, I went down to Georgia Tech. I was going to be an aeronautical engineer. So that just didn't happen. It didn't work out that way.
You mentioned you'd been interested in aviation. Was there something that lit that spark for you, that made you catch that bug?
I was a Boy Scout in Troop 8 here in Memphis. Scoutmaster had a little airplane, and he took me up and flew me around, and that turned it on.
Do you remember what that felt like, that first time up in the air?
Not really. I don't remember that. I remember what kind of airplane it was. It was a rear-wing Sportster, 65 horsepower, side-by-side seating. And that's what I remember.
A little different from what you'd end up in the war. But speaking of the war, it seems to me that everybody who lived through that period has some kind of memory about December 7th and how they found out that America had been drawn into war. You have a memory of that day?
I was sitting on my bed studying English grammar. I never learned it, but I was studying it anyway. And my mother called and told me that it happened.
Was that an eye-opener for you?
I was not really expecting that, no. But I was just 17 years old at the time, so I didn't keep up with that kind of thing. I was into music at the time, so yeah.
What kind of music?
Well, I played in a dance band and a marching band, saxophone and clarinet, and in the Children's Symphony Orchestra, I played the flute.
Multi-talented guy. And you told us you went off to Georgia Tech, but we know the timeline, as so many Americans were. Your plans were interrupted by World War II. How did that unfold, that you ended up in the Army Air Corps?
Well, I knew I was going to be drafted. I turned 18 2 months after the war started. And while I was at Georgia Tech, I had to sign up for the draft. I was 5'3", 135 pounds, and I was prime. I was cannon fodder for sure. So after I was at Georgia Tech, I transferred to Mississippi State, doing the same thing. I was closer to home. I could come home on the weekends or every other weekend. So I was at Starkville, Mississippi, close to Columbus, Mississippi, Mississippi State College for Women. Hi, Diane. So they came over in December of 42 and said, "Join the reserve now, and you'll be the last to be called." So 2 months later, they called me.
All of a two-month reprieve.
Yes.
Where'd you go from there?
My call was given to me on my birthday, And I had 1 week to report to Miami Beach for basic training. Spent 2 months down there.
Was that an adjustment for you? Were there some rude awakenings there or a piece of cake? No pun intended, Mr. Baker.
Piece of cake. Really, it was not very much. I expected it. And all of it that I expected came true.
For real?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I went from Miami Beach to North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. Actually, Davidson College right outside. From there, I went to Nashville for whatever I was going to do, deciding what I could do. Found out there I was colorblind, red and green colorblind, so I couldn't be a pilot. And they asked me, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'd like to be a navigator. They said, well, navigation school all full. What else would you like to do? Well, what's left? Bombardier school. So that's what I did.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who joined the Army Air Corps with the hopes of being a pilot, and at some point that path was derailed or detoured. Emotionally, was that difficult for you to hear, hey, you're colorblind, we're not going to let you do this?
Not really, no. I knew I was going to do something in the air. That was the main thing.
If you become the bombardier, then technically you've got some situations where you overrule the pilot, right? And you're in charge?
Yeah, on the bomb run, the pilot has the altitude and the speed, and the bomb site has all of the other parts of it. You can tramming into the wind or speed and all that kind of thing. That was all the bomb site.
And as you trained to become a bombardier, were there any elements of that path, the different things you had to do, the different planes you had trained in that brought any challenges for you?
Challenges, yes. Learning to use that blasted thing was a pretty difficult thing to do. It was not all that complicated, but I thought it was. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I got through it all right, though.
I think I'm going to steal that line for a few situations down the road. It wasn't all that complicated, but I thought it was. Boy, that's how we learn. How quickly did they progress you through this training to get you in the air and overseas?
Well, I went to basic training at Santa Ana, California, and that was mostly Morse code and exercises. From there, I went to Kingman, Arizona for gunnery training, and I got my gunnery wings. Went from there, they sent me to bombardier training at Deming, New Mexico, got my wings there, and they sent me to crew training at Biggs Field at El Paso. So it took about 6.5 months after that, overseas.
And how did you feel about that idea? I'm sure you'd heard something about what your odds were in the air, what the enemy presence was like, what you'd be up against.
Well, the thing was that the Luftwaffe, by the time I got over there, which was in August of 44, and that was June the 6th, so I was 2 months later getting over there. So all of that, the Luftwaffe, by the time we got there, had been pretty well what they called suppressed. And that meant that they didn't have any pilots. They had lots of aircraft still, but they didn't have the pilots.
It's still not a walk in the park. Tell me about the journey over and the guys that you were with. What bomb group were you in, by the way?
464th Bomb Group, 778th Bomb Squadron at Pantanella, Italy. That's way, way down south in Italy. Going over, I went over on the Kungsholm, a Swedish luxury liner. Got there in the first part of August. Landed in Liverpool, and they put us on the big 6x trucks at night. And they had blacked out all of the headlights except 1 inch high and 2 inches long so that the Germans couldn't see too much of the light if they were up there. 60 miles an hour at night. No lights, in convoy of 8 big trucks. But we got safely to the depot, replacement depot, which was incidentally 2 barracks. That's what it was. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Am I inferring from your narrative there that you felt a little more afraid for your life on that ride in England than in the air over Europe?
Almost always, that's for sure. Anyway, I spent 2 weeks there, and all the aircraft came by, came down real low and buzzed us to say, welcome, we're going to get you shot at. So I spent 2 weeks there, then they sent us to London, then down to the west part of England, and put us on an aircraft which was a transport version of the B-24s. It was C-82.
And on that very same aircraft that day was a history-making general. We'll have Luke reveal his identity when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for more on today's guest, 100-year-old Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 100-year-old Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee. He used to bake birthday cakes for Elvis Presley, and he was kind enough to bake some of his famous love cookies for me. Absolutely delicious. When we left off, Luke was a 20-year-old second lieutenant about to experience his first taste of combat as a B-24 bombardier. He had made it to England and was making his way to what would eventually be his base in Pantanella, Italy.
And on that trip down there, we had a general on board, the first black general in the United States, going to visit his son down there at just north of us down there. I don't remember the town right now. The name would never stuck with me. And I got into Morocco. We got in North Africa in August in our winter uniforms, and we were there for 2 weeks in our winter uniform before they sent us over to Italy to the replacement depot there, which was two tents. Uh-huh. It was not quite as good as the one in England.
So it sounds like you did a little sweating in Morocco.
That we did. And incidentally, they housed us in the palace. The stables, which were all marble, all they had to do was get the poop out for the horses, just wash it down, and all it went.
And when you mentioned the first black general, you're talking about General Davis of the Tuskegee Airmen?
Yes, sir. That was the guy. Brigadier General. That was him.
Well, and I've got to ask you about that because we didn't live through it. And, you know, today's young people, they may hear this and that about the civil rights movement or race relations. Here you grew up in Memphis before the war. I'm sure it's a lot different than what it is today. And the military was still segregated. How did you feel about all that? And what was it like to meet this gentleman who made history as the first black general?
Well, it was great, actually. The gentleman was really knowledgeable and gave us the information, nothing secret, but how the war was going and what was going on. And of course, we didn't know because nobody told us what was going on. Anyway, we're ready to do it again.
So you're getting closer to your first mission. I want to rewind the tape just a little bit, and I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember when you were heading overseas, having any thoughts of, hey, I don't know if I'm ever going to see America again. I don't know if I'm going to make it home from this.
That is so true. I kept telling everybody, oh, nothing's going to happen to us, but I knew differently. Yeah, yeah.
And eventually some things would happen. Tell me about your first mission. What was that like?
The first mission was to Budapest, and we had a target, which was an oil refinery, and in the bend of the Danube River right next to Budapest. It was good for us because we did the job. Of course, we did not, as our crew, being the first mission, we were not ever anywhere doing anything except dropping the bombs when the lead ship dropped their bombs. The target was one large building and 10 large tanks. And when we left, it was no longer there. Mm. We hit it. Mm-hmm. Did good job.
Some of these questions may sound goofy, but I'm just wondering what that feels like. A man your age, you're only 20 years old, and you're in the nose of that bomber, and it's your responsibility to hit that target. Was there some pressure you felt? Adrenaline, responsibility? What was coursing through your veins?
Yes and no. Both. We had some problems on the aircraft. Our ball gunner was stuck in his turret and couldn't get out. And I told the guys in the back, get him out. And they said, we don't know how. I did. So I went back and got him out of there. And when we started back forward to get, I hook him up to oxygen and another electric circuit, while the bomb hit the target, and we could see it while we were there. And it demolished the whole thing. We had 6 aircraft, and each one of us would carry 10 500-pound bombs, and it took that thing right out of there.
It's got to be an eye-opening experience to see something like that, just the scope and magnitude of that?
Yeah, that is certainly something else, I'm telling you. One situation when Diane took us to England, the people that were in charge of driving us around were from Hungary, and one guy was from Budapest. And I told him about my first mission. He says, well, that it's still there. And I said, it wasn't there when I left.
Well, and you said something else there about, you know, your crewmate who's stuck in the turret. Was that because it had been shot up by flak or what?
No, that was not it. He had on an electric suit, which is a nylon suit with wires in it, mm-hmm. and the electricity stopped working in his turret. So he couldn't move the turret, and of course he didn't have any heat, and he would have frozen to death back there because the temperature up there was minus 60. And it still is up there at that at altitude. It's still minus 60. So I did get him out of there and hook him up front. And before I went back, I told the navigator how to hit the switches and all that to drop the bombs when the lead ship dropped theirs.
So you left your post and trusted somebody else to do your job, because if you didn't, your crewmate would have frozen to death. What did you know that the other guys didn't know about how to, without electricity, get him out of there?
The switch, mechanical switch, is just like one of those windows right there. Mm-hmm. It just has a little lever on it, and just put that and then turn the crank to raise him up. Mm-hmm. I had to lower the gun straight down so the door would open and get him out of there. Mm-hmm. That's what I did.
Well, I bet he was awfully grateful for that.
Well, both of us are little, and I had to take care of that guy that's my size. I had to do that. Absolutely.
What kind of rapport did you have with your crew?
Oh, we were all great friends. The way the Army stacks you up, if you do a certain job, they give you a certain position in the service. I was a second lieutenant. Everybody else in the crew behind us back there and in the nose were all enlisted men. But, hey, we had drinks together all the time.
Yeah, that's not always the case between officers and enlisted. So that was your first mission. And I'm sure as they started to pile up, you got a little taste of some of the things you were up against. Did you encounter some anti-aircraft fire?
Oh, yes. We went to Munich a couple of different times, Vienna once, and that was the worst one. Wiener Neustadt and Bleckhammer, B-L-E-K-H-A-M-M-E-R, which was another oil refinery. Mm-hmm. And while they were using coal there to make oil, as well as drilling for oil, that I didn't really understand. But I still don't understand it. But anyway, they did, and they were making oil out of coal there as well as drilling for oil at the same time. Yeah, I had two what they called milk runs for railroad bridges. One was in Czechoslovakia, and the other one was in North Italy. So there we were again with six airplanes, each one carrying 10 500-pound bombs. And each time for those two targets that we were, only one bomb hit the target. But we destroyed a bunch of rail lines as well as digging holes for the farmers to do their plowing.
The unintended consequences. Well, I'm just, most of us have never and will never live through this. When you're on that bomb run and you start to see the flak in front of you, around you, everywhere, can you put us in that nose of that bomber and help us understand what that's like?
Actually, it's not fun, because you can see those little blossoms up there in the air, and we've had them come very close to us, and at one time we actually had a solid hit, but it didn't explode. Mm. It tore off the left elevator of our aircraft, and it flipped us straight up in the air, stalled out, and fell over on the back, and it took some 4,000 feet before the pilot could gain control of it enough, because half of the elevator was gone. Everybody in the aircraft, but the navigator and the bombardier and the two waist gunners were all strapped in, but we bounced around in the front end of that airplane just like we were ping pong balls, and it bruised us up pretty badly, I'll tell you.
Okay, so you're describing that like it's a ride at an amusement park or something, but I'm thinking, holy cow, what a nightmare. How disorienting, how terrorizing. So the enemy shell actually hits the plane, yes, flips you upside down, and you're bouncing around inside the cockpit.
Yeah, right up in front there. That's where we were. Actually, it bruised us up. The navigator and me, we weren't tied down, so yes, we were bruised up pretty badly because of that.
And probably hard to tell what's up, what's down, where you are, and what's going to happen.
That's for sure. We really didn't know what was going on. You know, it's just a very sudden shock, and primarily that bomb, that blasted anti-aircraft didn't explode, because if it had, we would not have been there. That would have been the end.
So you talk about miracles, one, that it doesn't explode, and then that your pilot's able to recover control 4,000 feet later. I don't know how long that took, but I imagine it felt like a long time.
It was swift. I would imagine it was maybe a good 30 seconds to a minute, mm-hmm, while we were going up and then coming back down again. Yeah, yeah. And we were right under the bomb stream. Bombers up there in front of us looked up out of the nose of the aircraft there, and there were those big guys up there with their bomb bay doors open, and it was about time for all the bombs to go away. So I screamed on the interphone, turn right, we're under the stream. And he did, and we got away from him. And we flew home alone.
Wow. I bet the respect you had for your pilot grew a little bit after that mission.
Well, I had respect for them on being able to do what they did anyway. You know, the pilots did not have experience like the Blue Angels. If the pilot had 400 hours total, he was really an experienced pilot. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they had to fly in that formation, and we didn't fly close formations. The aircraft had a 100-foot wingspan, and we were supposed to be 50 feet away. Each wingtip was supposed to be 50 feet away. So you got one lead ship, and he's 100 feet, and you got 50 feet on either side, that's another 100 feet. So we didn't fly real close.
And which mission was that?
Well, that was Vienna South Ordnance Depot. That must have been about the 16th mission. I had a total of 20.
Well, and my thought is, when you go through something like that, where you so easily could have had your life cut short at 20 years old, and you survive it. When you get ready for mission number 17, are you feeling invincible or the opposite? Like, hey, something's coming pretty soon. We can't keep dodging this.
Yeah, well, that's true. So true. Yeah, I remember the last three a lot better.
When it comes to the role that you played, again, on the bomb run, you're in control. The plane's not moving. If there's flak at your altitude, you're just going to fly right through it. But it's your responsibility to make sure that bomb hits its target. And that whether or not it hits that target makes a big difference in a lot of different ways. Is that a responsibility that you allowed yourself to contemplate, or was it more out of sight, out of mind?
Well, I knew we had to do the job. Mm-hmm. And yes, we were going to do it, whatever it was. No matter what the other guy was doing up there shooting at us, we were going to hit the target if we could. Yes, we did it.
And you've mentioned the six bomber formations that you were flying in. Did y'all ever have fighter escort?
Oh, yeah, we had fighter escort. We had Mr. Davis's sons fly with us most of the time.
The Red Tails were protecting you.
They were protecting us. And incidentally, they flew the job by the book. They were in 51s. They would fly by the book. We would be in the bomber stream of some 600 to 700 bombers at a time. And they would fly by the book where everybody else would be up at 40,000 feet in the 38s and the 47s and 51s. But the Red Tails were right with us the whole time until we got to the target. And then they didn't go over the target with us. And I don't blame them. No.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out as we go from that close call on your 16th mission to your 20th and final mission. But you said you remember those last three a lot better. Anything on number 17, 18, 19 that gave you a hint of what was coming on number 20?
No, they were just the routine type thing where we went to the target and dropped our bombs. I never was lead bombardier. So, yes, I was just hitting the toggle switch every time the guy up front dropped his bombs, I released mine. And incidentally, we had a paddle on board the ship that would divide the bombs into distances apart, anywhere from 50 feet to 300 feet apart for each bomb. So if I never had to stretch about 300 feet, but most of the time we're just 100 feet apart. Yeah, and the bombs were mostly 500-pounders. One time we had 2,000-pounders, and we carried six of those.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, this bombardier's 20th and final mission. What went wrong on that B-24, and how in the world did he survive? Hear it from this 100-year-old veteran himself when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating conversation today with 100-year-old Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee, where on August 24th, Forever Young Veterans will hold its annual fundraising gala. ForeverYoungVets.org is the website for the amazing organization that connected us to Luke, and I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. If you're a regular listener, I bet you've been starting to think, as I have, that we might have to continue this conversation on to another episode, because I've already told you he's an ex-prisoner of war, and we haven't even heard yet about how he became a guest of the Gestapo. We've heard some highlights and some close calls from his first 19 missions. So, your 20th mission. I'm sure you've thought about that day on a lot of the rest of the days in these 100 years that you've been here. Boy, 80 years since this happened that we're talking about. Can you take me through that day, start to finish, with what you remember?
We were at Pantanella, Italy, which I said is way down south. And we had a 5,000-foot runway and a 500-foot overrun. We would take off in form 20 seconds apart. So if you have 24 aircraft or 30 aircraft going off, the last guys had a bunch of rough bumps, all that rough air kind of get off the ground. Had to get off the ground at 120 miles an hour. That's when you could lift off. And we flew at 160 airspeed. And on that day, we used up every single inch of the runway before that aircraft got to 120 to lift off. Formed up, and we would form up in what they called a racetrack pattern. In other words, the lead aircraft was take off first, and then he would fly out and do like a racetrack. And everybody else was formed up on him, and then when we go out over the Adriatic Sea and then go forward from there. And we'd stay away from Italy because the anti-aircraft guns on shore would try to, would shoot at us if we didn't. So there was one city, Trieste, up in the north, and every time we got close to that, they always started firing into the air so we could see that they had anti-aircraft guns. We went over and got over Austria, and we missed Innsbruck. We went around that one, and we were at 22,000 feet, and underneath us was a solid layer of clouds. And we lost the prop control on number four, which is the right outboard, and then about 5 minutes later we lost the supercharger on number three, which is the right inboard. And a few minutes later, the number two on the left inboard supercharger quit. So the aircraft won't fly on two engines at that altitude, which meant the two inboard engines weren't doing anything. So we started going down. Opened the bomb bay doors, got rid of the bombs, threw out all the machine guns, and I was throwing ammunition out, long strands of 50 caliber ammunition. Now, the B-24 flight deck is up about 3 feet, 2.5 to 3 feet over the bottom of the aircraft, and from the flight deck, you crawl on the right-hand side forward past the nose wheel to get to the front turret and the navigation and bomb sight. So I looked up, and my pilot was getting up out of his seat, and I didn't hear the alarm bell go off nor the intercom because I was not on intercom. So I crawled forward and got my parachute, which was a chest pack, and crawled back and got out of the aircraft before my pilot got out. I beat him. I was swift. Now, if I was your size, I wouldn't have got out of there that fast because you couldn't get under there. So. But I did. And I was in the air for about 10 seconds. As I pulled the rip cord with my right hand. It didn't open, so I put both hands on the D-ring and pulled on it, and it opened. And then about 10 seconds later, I hit the trees, flipped me upside down, and turned me into a snowball. And I lit upside down, and it knocked me unconscious. And I was out for quite a while. But I lit in a big snowbank. If it hadn't hit in that, it would have broke my neck, that's for sure.
So again, you've told this story before, and I guess every time you tell it, it's easier to tell and maybe doesn't jar you as much as it's jarring me and all the people listening. If you hadn't acted so swiftly, or if you had been a foot taller like I am, you probably wouldn't be talking to me right now. You saw your pilot getting ready to leave, and he's supposed to be the last one out. So you know, uh-oh, if I don't do this right now, I'm dead.
That's right. I knew it.
So you scramble up there, get your parachute on, get out of the plane, and the chute won't open. I mean, I think I would panic in that situation.
Well, it wasn't but a fraction of a second. Because I was swift on getting that right hand on it and then the left hand to pull it, that D-ring, so that it would open.
And you said only 10 seconds before impact, and you're knocked unconscious. Do you have a guess, and maybe from hearing from others too, what altitude y'all might have been when you got out of that plane?
Well, as I said, the cloud cover was at 12,000 feet, and the navigator says, after I talked to him afterwards, that the map showed that the altitude at 12,000 feet. The rocks in those big mountains up there were 12,000 feet. So the clouds in the mountains were the same height. So we had to get out of that thing.
So you said you're out for a while. You're unconscious for a while. I guess the next thing everybody wants to know is, what did you wake up to?
Upside down in the snowbank. It's difficult to turn up back right side up. And when I got up out of there, I heard some voices up further up the mountain. And it was my navigator hung up in the top, in a tree. And my pilot and co-pilot were yelling at him instructions on how to get out of there. And he finally took his knife and cut the shroud lines, and he came down. There were two little boys down on a trail. They were 10 to 12 years old. And the older one told the younger one to go to the village down there. And they came back with a soldier. He had a gun. The little boys had a gun also. Mm. I also had a .45 on my hip. It was there to shoot the bomb sight. That's what I was supposed to do with the .45. But I didn't do that. Sorry.
So, and for people who are confused, you're supposed to shoot the bomb sight so the Germans don't have access to that technology, but if you had taken time to do that, you wouldn't have survived.
Well, quite possibly, but the thing is, it didn't really make a bunch of difference because the Germans already had over 1,000 aircraft down. So they knew exactly what that thing did.
Situational awareness. So did everyone make it out of the plane alive?
Everyone got out of the plane all right. Everyone survived and came back to the United States, all 10 of us.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty miraculous right there. But at the time, you're dealing with a whole lot of uncertainty. And you mentioned that you had the 45 on your hip. Were you processing whether or not you could use that and survive?
Well, as I said, I lived in a snowbank. And this was the 16th of November, 44. Mm-hmm. And no. I handed that gun to that little boy. We were transported out of there. Oh, we walked down to the village, and it's Saalfelden, S-A-A-L-F-E-L-D-E-N, Saalfelden, Austria. Was there for 2 nights in jail. It was one room jailhouse is what it was for all 10 of us. One jail cell. And they put us on a German truck, and it was a steam engine truck. Hmm. On the passenger side right behind the door was a big tank, just like a water heater. And they put some limbs in there, some wood in there, and it heated the steam up, and off we went.
Some very unique experiences. And I'm thinking, too, I'm thinking back through all the POWs I've interviewed over the years, and dozens who, like you, were shot down over occupied Europe. Not too many of them got to the ground with their whole crew. A lot of times they were scattered over miles and miles, and they didn't know if the rest of their crew survived. Yeah. How big of a help was that for you to have the rest of those guys with you?
Oh, yeah. It lasted about 2 days. Then they separated the officers from the enlisted men. The Germans are like that, and the Brits are the same way. So. But anyway, they took us to an airfield. I'm talking about a grass strip at Munich. And from there, they took us to an interrogation center at Frankfurt.
And I've heard a lot of stories about that infamous interrogation center and the way that went down. Do you remember what was going through your mind before they lit into you, before they grilled you?
I was in solitary confinement for 14 days before they called me up to go. And incidentally, they fed us through a doggy door in the door. And the food was 1 5- or 6-ounce cup of what they call soup. If a chicken or a vegetable had walked through it, it was a mile away when they did it. And two thin slices of rye bread. And then they called me up to see the major. And incidentally, had gone to college in England, so he spoke perfect English. Didn't speak American, but he spoke English. That's totally different.
And you would know. So just for us to understand, and I've heard about this solitary at Frankfurt, pretty cramped quarters. Maybe it's a good thing to be 5'3 when you're in a cell like that. But for 14 days, I guess they're trying to wear you down before they ask you anything, huh?
That may be so. And then again, when I went to see the major, the first thing he did was hand me an English cigarette. And then during the interview, he says, "Well, how is Ed?" "Well, that's a common name. Who are you talking about?" Says Ed Crump. He was our Democratic mayor in Memphis. So they knew where I was from. Of course, I didn't tell them. They gave us a paper to write on that listed everything they wanted to know. And I didn't tell them anything that they didn't already know. And so they had people in the United States collecting all this information. It was always in the paper. When I would move from one place to the next, "Luke is here. Luke moved this day." So they knew everything about me. They knew what town I was from, who the mayor was, and all that sort of stuff.
That's got to blow your mind a little bit.
Actually, it certainly did. They already knew who I was and why I was. Yeah.
I know, again, you've got 80 years of history since then, and things sink in over time. But at the time, did you think you were going to survive this war now that you're in the predicament you're stuck in?
I prayed about it a lot. Continually. And from interrogation center, they sent us to a Red Cross camp where they outfitted us with a regular United States Army overcoat and a scarf and a helmet cap, wool helmet cap. And incidentally, I was in Troop 8 Boy Scouts, and one of my friends was in the same troop. His name was Tom Young. And at that place, he and I met each other 4,000 miles away, POW camp, and here's two guys in the same Boy Scout troop.
Wow. Talk about a welcome sight, huh? Yeah. Your Boy Scout friend on the other side of the world. How many GIs do you think were at that Red Cross camp?
There were easily 200. Easy there, yeah.
So how'd you guys spot each other?
Well, we were called out for appel, which is the head count. And my middle name is Layton, Luke Layton. And Tom came up to me and he says, "Layton, is that you?" I said, "Tom, is that you?" Yeah. And he had actually gone down the same day I went down on a target at Innsbruck.
And believe it or not, that small world encounter half a world away is what would allow Luke's family back home in Tennessee to find out that he was still alive. That's a story you absolutely will not want to miss. But unfortunately, we're going to have to wait until our next episode because we're out of time for this week. Don't forget to learn more about Forever Young Veterans and the amazing work that organization does. Luke's going to give us some perspective on that next time, too. But just go to foreveryoungvets.org, and I have that link up at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.